We kick off the hour by getting on board the G&M Family Market phone line and welcoming to the show a regular contributor to NPR's Weekend Edition and all kinds of publications from Sports Illustrated to Harper's, The Guardian, Rolling Stone, and more, Colin Fleming joining us. Colin, welcome to Downtown.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rich.
Well, today, and you write about an awful lot of topics, but we wanted to focus on the film world today, and in particular, a couple of giants of the industry, and one of whom would have been celebrating his 100th birthday this weekend in Robert Mitchum. And I wonder if the younger generation even has a grasp on who this great actor is.
I would tend to think they probably don't, unless they linger around Turner Classic Movies from time to time. But Mitchum was, I guess one thing that would give him cachet with younger people today is he had that notorious pot bust in late 1940s, which seems like kind of quaint now, but at the time was just like this big transgression against social mores. But he played a lot of characters in noir films, which I think dovetail pretty well with our times right now, where they're morally bankrupt in some ways. A character is placed in a situation that really can't have a good kind of outcome, and he sort of goes down a rabbit hole where everything just snowballs on him. And Mitchum was really the best, I think, actor we had in that kind of role.
Yeah, and people often look back at a Steve McQueen as a guy who sort of epitomized cool, but Mitchum had that down before McQueen even rolled along.
Yeah, it's like the word swagger might as well have been invented for Mitchum. You take something like 1947's Out of the Past, and I think it's a film that we could put up there. I think it's Mitchum's best. It's one we could put up there with something like Hitchcock's Vertigo or John Ford's The Searchers or Orson Welles' Citizen Kane. It's just one of the best films ever made in this country. And I think part of the reason, really, is that Mitchum, besides his brawny physical presence, carries so much of the film in his voice, has this prismatic quality, this wonderfully sonorous quality, and it does a lot of the heavy lifting in that kind of film with the flashback sequences, which he would tend to narrate.
One of my favorites, and Out of the Past was great, but I have a sweet spot of affection for Night of the Hunter and his incredibly strong performance as a Reverend Harry Powell, who was just an unforgettable character.
Yeah, I don't know if you can get much creepier than Mitchum is in that film. Like, it's one of the things you watch now and you're like, oh, wait, they were allowed to do that? You couldn't do that now. And he has Love and Hate, of course, tattooed on his knuckles. And when he does the whole battle of left-hand, right-hand thing, just like kind of onanistic as you watch it, too, it's like, this man probably shouldn't be like around the young. And, of course, that's what he's doing in the film, is pursuing these kids who are sort of shepherded over by the wonderful actress from the silent era, T.W. Griffith era, Lillian Gish, who certainly holds her own with Mitchum in that film in one of her best roles.
Now, one of his movies, I don't know that it was a great film, but it certainly showcased what a multi-talented guy Robert Mitchum was Thunder Road, that he co-wrote the script, he produced it, and even co-wrote and performed the theme song that became a big hit in the country charts.
And inspired the Bruce Springsteen song, too.
Yeah.
It was like kind of one of your quintessential like midnight movies. Like, a lot of times it was just schlock. Like horrible films like Robot Monster. You're up at like 2:30 in the morning. You're like, what on earth is this? Ed Wood. But Thunder Road was one of those. It's about running moonshine and having like your car kitted out so that you can have like the whiskey and the feds won't catch you. And it was like a passion project of his that he made. I think just simply like his son is in it. And like, if you watch Cheers, it's like, just to speak to like how impassioned people become about like Thunder Road, whenever like in the early episodes, whenever it would come on late at night, Sam Malone and Coach would have to stop whatever they were doing to watch it.
That's right.
They'd rope in Diane for it, too.
And that music was something that he continued to pursue right to the end of his life, wrote a lot of songs, had a top 10 hit on the country charts with the Little Old Wine Drinker Me, and even composed an oratorio.
Yeah, he liked his calypso music, too. So if you ever wanted to bust out, like, the 1950s, kind of like Elvis, Tiki, you know, set for, like, the back porch, I guess you could get, like, into a Robert Mitchum songster kind of vibe going on.
Now, of course, apologies to Robert De Niro, who's one of our great actors of all time, but his Max Cady, for my money, had nothing on Mitchum's original.
No, I don't think so. You're always conscious of De Niro. To me, he's acting in that role. And I never want to be, like, aware of you acting. It's like when someone's writing and they're like, oh, I just have these extended similes. And, like, you're like, okay, you're doing a move. I know when you're doing a move, it takes me out of what I'm reading or what I'm watching. Mitchum is just, when he's Max Cady, he is Max Cady. Yeah. There's, like, nothing else that he could be for the duration of that film, such that you think that Cady is out there somewhere in the world and you hope not to encounter him. That's how, like, transportive Mitchum could be. And he was always self-deprecating, saying he wasn't much of an actor. He had two acting styles, with a horse and without. But he was one of those people, I feel like, who was so good at what he did that he didn't feel he had this need to prove it, really. It just was what was, really.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Well, no better source that I can think of when it comes to Boston things than our friend Bob Ryan, who's a regular on our show here. And Bob has insisted many times that the greatest Boston-based movie of all time, 1973's The Friends of Eddie Coyle with Robert Mitchum.
Yeah, hands down. I actually wrote a piece saying just that today for Salon. I think there is... It bothers me how often... Even Boston filmmakers tend to get Boston wrong. They get Boston accents wrong. Mitchum was from Connecticut, and if you want to hear like a proper Boston accent in a Boston-based film, there's that sequence in Eddie Coyle near the end where they're at the old Boston Garden, and he's oohing and aahing over Bobby Orr, and that to me is quintessential Boston accent. But it's a wonderful film. I mean, you can go, for instance, the bar where Dylan, sort of the bartender who works both sides of the street, that's at the old Tower Records at the top end of Newberry Street. But that's post-noir, I think, of almost is Eddie Coyle. Mitchum's only on screen for a quarter of that film, and yet he completely carries it.
Yeah, and what was, I mean, I'm thinking back, I mean, that's 40-some years ago, so he was in his 50s at that time, but there was a weariness that made him feel even older in that film.
He looks older. He looks very hangdog. He has the bags under his eyes, and like when you look up his age, you're like, huh, that's baffling. Like, you shouldn't look like sort of that antiquated at that point. He gave credit for that role to the really bad middle-aged man's haircut he got for like $5.
And then he continued to work until very late in his life, even in parts that maybe he was a little too old to play, but even compelling in not always great miniseries work.
Yeah, he did. He would also play. He played Philip Marlowe, and even when you thought like, okay, this is a stretch, maybe this romantic interest is a stretch, he just had this presence that went beyond the physical. It was sort of old Hollywood, but it also went beyond old Hollywood. He clearly truckled to nobody and just set up his own rules, really, both as an actor, as a person. And you don't see that kind of gravitas a lot. And he certainly clashed with a bunch of directors, but once he set aside some of the shenanigans, you knew you were always going to get a top draw performance from him.
Absolutely. Well, anybody who hasn't seen any of the Mitchum films, or have seen some and not all, check out to so many of them, but certainly Friends of Eddie Coyle, Out of the Past, you got to watch those and learn about this incredible talent. We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. We also wanted to talk about one of my favorites, Orson Welles, who, well, when it comes to larger-than-life people in the film business, he's got to be near the top of the list, both figuratively and literally.
Yeah, and I think he has sort of a Mitchum aspect to him in a sense that, like with film noir, it's about things coming apart. And that's sort of what Orson Welles' career was about. After The Magnificent Ambersons, his second film, the follow-up to The Mighty Citizen Kane, was released in the summer of 1942, basically, the keys of the kingdom were taken from Welles. He was kicked out of Hollywood. Everyone wanted to see him get his comeuppance, which is really what Ambersons is about. And he spent decades with everyone against him. No one funding him, having to just scrounge around for acting jobs to make his movies. And some of them, like Othello, 1952, he had to shoot over like 3 or 4 years. Couldn't afford costumes in Othello at one point, and they wanted to do this like ornate sequence. So instead they said, let's just shoot in a Turkish bath. Everyone wears towels. We'll just nick them from the hotel. And I think like we think of Welles as kind of like the golden boy of cinema, but that ended in his mid-20s in 1942. And he had to hustle like crazy after that and somehow still managed to make some of our greatest pictures that we have, which he shouldn't have been able to.
And, of course, Citizen Kane still appears very high, often either number one or number two in the list of the greatest American films of all time. But what people may not know is that it was by far not any kind of a box office success.
No, there were attempts to suppress it, to destroy the negative. Welles hit upon the idea of having tents and showing it like his road shows in tents. And it was panned. Amberson's did even worse. The studio head at RKO, if you read these agonizing letters he writes to Welles, because he believes in his genius, but at the same time he's saying to him, we are hemorrhaging money, and your next picture has to be some kind of like action-based thriller success. We can't just lose money on your attempts to educate America. And like, it's heartbreaking. The studio head gets fired. Welles gets kicked out on his rear. And like these years of just fighting to get funding, to do a lot of Shakespeare pictures, there wasn't any acting job he wouldn't slum it for to get money. And of course, everyone remembers the wine commercials, for like the second most popular Welles hit on YouTube, where he's telling you that we won't serve this horrible, horrible jug wine before his time.
How important, because he had an eye for talent, I thought he got some of the best performances of Joseph Cotten's career out of him, but how important was a guy like Greg Toland to his work?
Toland was crucial, and what most people are going to say is that because of Citizen Kane in and of itself, best picture ever made, that's limiting. Welles showed up. He didn't want to leave New York City to go to Hollywood because he had his theater stuff going on there, his radio stuff going on. And Hollywood kept upping their price till eventually Welles said, yeah, what the hell, I'll go. He goes, and like over a weekend, Toland teaches him everything about the camera. And Welles was a genius with photographic memory. So he was able to take what Toland taught him that like weekend. And they only worked on the one film together. And he was able to press that into service throughout his career. So he could show up, look through the viewfinder, or he wouldn't even have to, and have the perfect way to light and align a shot. Welles' visual eye, it's like Rembrandt. I don't even know how you match it. And it was something he had that Toland helped him hone. So he was crucial to Welles.
And of course, for a guy who was so talented in so many areas, the ultimate insight had to be that loss of creative control. And so many of his films were edited against his wishes. A Touch of Evil, certainly the one that so many people have talked about, was it 3-4, maybe more years ago than that, that the original edit that he wanted was released. And you can see the difference.
Yeah, Charlton Heston basically kind of acted as turncoat. He brought Welles in on that project. He was the star. And then when things started getting a little thorny with the studio, Heston basically sold Welles down the river. And when you watch that film, Welles was heartbroken that it was not a major financial success. If you watch it now, it's absolutely riveting. I was at the theater and it was playing last summer. And normally what happens at the theater is when a picture is done, everyone claps. When Touch of Evil was over, not only did no one clap, no one like stood up for a while. They were just like, oh my God.
Yeah,
The look on everyone's face, like they were stapled to their seats, because you don't see pictures like that. And yeah, his work was often butchered, and he found other creative outlets. He wrote a wonderful play, which is kind of like a meta version of Moby Dick that most people don't know about. And he was always doing theater. He did Othello on the stage again after the film came out, playing the Moor. So he was always with his hand in something.
And I love Welles so much that even some of his late career work I found absolutely compelling. I'm a huge fan of F for Fake.
Oh, yeah, that's a wonderful film. And it's like one of those things. Now in today's society, we speak so often of comparables. What can we compare something to? It's a cross between The Sopranos and Harry Potter. Oh, great. I like both those. I like this. What do you compare F is for Fake to? Like, I don't know of anything like it. It's kind of a documentary, but it's not really a documentary because it's fake. Like, it's fiction, but it's also sort of not fiction because there are some people in it who actually, like, exist out in the world. Welles was an obsessive magician. And you can, that's not surprising when you watch F is for Fake, because that's completely what that film is that it's a sort of cinematic sleight of hand. And it's done with a wink and a nudge. And yet, also at the same time, it's that same pure cinema that Hitchcock spoke of. And you just realize that, like, Welles, he's just a cut above everyone else. If you watch the television pilot he did for Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, Fountain of Youth in the 50s, it's like it didn't air, but then it won an award after. And he basically conquered television in one production that has some of the staging that you'd get from, like, a Eugene O'Neill play. Like, he was that adroit in everything he did. He was always chasing the money, and he was always shooting, basically, like, where you weren't allowed to shoot, and slumping down and hiding in the backs of cars and running when the cops came, and he certainly didn't have a lot of people backing him.
Well, and for the last several years of his life, he was chasing the money, and whenever he could, filming was going to be his final project, The Other Side of the Wind. He never finished it, and now word has come out that we may finally see a version of that. What do you think of this happening now that Welles has been gone all these years, that we finally may get to see this film?
I think it depends upon how you look at it and what you go in expecting. Certain artists can't really be edited. I mean, people can point things out or make suggestions, but I don't know how you would go about editing, say, like James Joyce with Ulysses. And I think Welles is in that category, that it needs to come out correctly through his vision, or else someone else is going to be at something of a loss. At the same time, Welles was the type of artist who, even when he is enduring butchering or intentions that just go wrong, there's something transcendent about his genius that works no matter what. So I doubt that it could be something at the level of just canonical films, but it will still be like an integral film that you have to see, where there will be sequences of virtuosic flourishes that will just be matchless. And you'll just, like Paganini, you'll just be like, how on earth did you do that, man? And then maybe it'll be gappy for a bit. And I mean, he worked on it for like 6 or 7 years. He was trying to get like funding from like some Shah in Iran. Like, it's just all so dodgy, you know? Like, he was really at that time hustling like harder than ever to finish this picture. I mean, at one point, Rich Little, the guy who does the impersonations, was cast, and then he was uncast. So it had a very chaotic kind of backstory.
Colin Fleming, the article on Mitchum, that'll be up this weekend on Salon?
Yeah, I assume it'll be up by Sunday.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to reading that. It's great talking with you, Colin. I hope we can do it again in our email correspondence. You mentioned maybe coming on in a couple of weeks to talk about Brian Epstein. We would love to do that.
No, that'd be great. That'd be fun.
All right, we'll do it, and we'll make a date. Colin, thanks so much for being with us.
All right, thank you.
That's Colin Fleming. Read his work on Salon.com. Here I'm on NPR's Weekend Edition and more.